Welcome to Authors on the Air. I'm your host, Pam Stack. We're proud to be part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. I want to make a quick announcement about two new releases that people have told me about. First of all, and I also want to pimp the Miami Book Fair, which begins November 11th and goes through the 18th. It is one of the largest book fairs in the country. Please, if you're in the area, go. So many great people are going to be there. I also want to make mention of two books that are new. The first one is from Lori Wilde, whose new book, The Christmas Key, releases today. And then also a new book from Regan Black, who writes a lot of really interesting different genres. It's called What She Knew. It's Breakdown Book 4. My guest today is one of my favorite people to talk to. Ever since I read IQ by Joe Ide, I thought it was the most brilliant and unusual book I had ever read in my life. Since then, Joe has two more after the initial IQ. The second book was Righteous, and the new book is called Wrecked. It is my absolute honor and privilege to have back on the show Joe Ide. Joe, thanks so much for coming back to Authors on the Air.
It is my pleasure, Pam, and I imagine it always will be.
Thank you. You are very kind to me, and I'm so glad we've maintained this friendship over the years and from all the great books. I have the hardcover in my hand, and I love all the blurbs that you get. Michael Conley, whom I mentioned to you in the green room, I had a chance to interview last month, said this about you: Joe Ide is the best new discovery I've come across in a long time, and Isaiah Quintabe is the kind of sleuth not seen on the mystery landscape before. It is absolutely true that I've never read a character like Isaiah. And yet I look at I've been reading an awful lot about you and your background, and you are originally from the area of Los Angeles about which you write. Isn't that true?
Yes. Not quite directly. My neighborhood in South Central was primarily black when I grew up, but it's now almost solidly Latino, and it's why I moved the location of the stories to East Long Beach, because it's more diverse there.
You know, it's interesting because you are considered an Asian American. I don't think you're black. Maybe you have some in your DNA, who knows? You know, we're all kind of all mixed up in the soup there. But you write stories about black characters that sound authentic to me. And although I, you know, have always grown up in a white bread neighborhood, I think that your characters ring true. Why is that?
Well, they were the people that I grew up with. I try and reflect the spirit of the people that I grew up with. And I really, in truth, wanted to be black. They were.
Why?
My friends
Why
were
was
just.
That?
I saw my friends as just being so cool, and myself as this sort of strange fringe kid. And, you know, I could wear. Everybody wore the same raggedy T-shirts and jeans, but.
Sure.
You know, I look raggedy, but they look cool. And I emulated my friends. You know, I really co-opted their speech and style, attitudes, musical taste, all of that. And so because that was the environment I grew up in, it's they are the strongest emotional attachments I have outside my family.
Were you easily accepted with your friends?
Yes. It was a much simpler time, and
yeah.
You know, I was just part of the furniture, and there wasn't. I don't ever remember ever getting flack from anybody about being Asian.
Who did you model Isaiah Quintave after? Because he is quite cerebral for his young age. He is a thinker, not a man of action necessarily. He does a lot of thinking about the conflict at which he is investigating, to which he investigates. Where did he come from?
Originally, he came from Sherlock Holmes. Sherlock was my idol back when I was growing up. And since then, he's evolved. I mean, Isaiah has a lot of things that I wanted to be. You know, he has that kind of quiet, cool of Sidney Poitier and Steve McQueen, where they don't say much, but you know they're in the room.
Yeah.
And I always wanted to be, you know, that guy, you know, the smartest guy in the room, had the edge on everybody and was brave and just and quick on his feet. And so a lot of Isaiah are my aspirations. And all of that kind of came together when it came time to write a book.
I know when we talked before, you told me that you had tried a lot of different professions, one of them being a teacher, but the kids kind of irritated the hell out of you, which I loved because I couldn't be a teacher either. I get that. I so get that, you know, and don't get me wrong. I love my grandkids, but we don't live in the same city. And so that's pretty good for me anyway, probably for them too. But when did you take a look in the mirror and say, I know what I want to do. I'm going to try writing this book. How did that come to you?
I was a screenwriter before I wrote the novel, and I worked a fair bit and worked for most of the major studios, but all of the screenplays that I wrote never got made. You know, I'd work on them for months, and in the end, they would fall out for one Hollywood reason after another. You know, the budget's too big, the star falls out, the studio head gets fired, and this happened to me over and over and over again. And finally, I got so frustrated, I really did burn out, and I associated so much failure with screenwriting. I mean, if you don't get the movies made, you know, really, what's the point?
Right.
It ended up maybe a dozen people would read the screenplays, so people from the studio and producers and development execs, over and over and over again, and finally, I just walked away. Nobody noticed, but I walked away, and I was really down and out for a while. I was really depressed. And I took long brooding walks with my dog, and I felt sorry for myself and thought about all the mistakes I had made. But finally, you know, writing is the only thing I know how to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so I decided to write a novel.
And you based it on loosely on your friends.
On my friends, on Sherlock Holmes,
and
many of the characters that I've read.
Now, do your friends in your former neighborhood, do you still speak to them, any of them?
Only one of my friends, my best friend actually, is still there.
Mm-hmm.
We call him D, the big D, and mm-hmm. he is in the same house, and he's been there his whole life. He's a mechanic. But he's the only one I'm in touch with. I think many of the guys that I hung with, I don't know what's happened to them. And he's the only guy. He's the only guy I stay in touch with.
Does he know about your writing success?
Yeah, he does. Yeah, he does. He's quite happy.
What does he think about your books and your characters? Or has he not read them? Maybe he has and I don't know. Maybe he's not a book guy.
I think he read the first one, and he liked the book, and we laughed about it because he recognized little pieces of people, you know, that we both know.
Really?
Within the characters, yeah. And he would say, you know, is that so-and-so? And I said, yep, I got that from him or her.
I think that's fascinating that he recognized your characters, and it probably made you laugh when you talked about it. You when you finished this book, the first draft, you had a very interesting contact with a relative that you barely knew, who actually helped you get published, didn't he?
Yes. His name is Francis Fukuyama. His name is Francis Fukuyama. He is a world-renowned political scientist. He consults with governments. He runs a Center for Democracy at Stanford. He's written 8 or 9 books. And
wow.
He's on the board at RAND. You know, he's on the board
wow.
at RAND. He's one of those kinds of guys.
Yeah.
And I had finished the manuscript, and I was just sending it out to readers, just literate friends. And I was thinking about sending it out to Francis, but then I was really reluctant. I mean, you know, he's on the board at RAND.
Yeah.
But I did. It was almost on a whim. And he's a very sweet man. And eventually he ended up reading it, and he liked it. And he asked me if I had an agent. And I said, no, I had to go get one. And he introduced me to his agent, a woman named Esther Neuber, who's been head of literary at ICM in New York for 25 years. So it's a huge, huge stroke of luck. And she got the book sold in a matter of weeks. So it was, when does that ever happen? I mean, really.
But I think the moon aligned with Mars, and you finally fell into what you really should have been doing, and all of it was prep for that, don't you think, Joe?
I absolutely think that. I really could not have written the book until I wrote it. And, you know, all my experiences in my life and motivation and need and the obsessive need to write something that was mine, all of those things came together. And I could not have written the book before that.
Are you intending to have your book translated from print to maybe the small or large screen?
The book's got optioned by for TV, for cable.
Mm-hmm.
And TV takes a long time.
Oh yes.
and so they're just now getting around to writing a pilot. That just started. And so terrific guy. I'm sorry?
Oh. Will you have any input?
Yeah. Yeah. The showrunner's a guy named Matt Carnahan, who came from House of Lies. And he's assembling a team of writers. And he's really a terrific guy. He's maybe the nicest guy I've ever met in showbiz. And he's open, and he really respects the material. And so he always wants to hear what I have to say. And so I go to the meetings, and I am heard. So that is unusual, and I'm very grateful to him and the studio.
I would imagine because, you know, the character is so unique. And I would hate for them, and who knows what's going to happen, and you don't have to say if the characters have been slotted yet, the actors have been chosen, but it would be a shame for them to turn this into a white book. Does that make sense to you when I say that?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, it could very well be, you know, Bosch in the Hood.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah.
they really don't feel that way. You know, I've talked to pretty much everybody involved, and they really want the show to be the book. So I'm really glad for that.
I want to tell you that, you know, when I started reading mystery and noir, because you kind of have, this is a spin, I think, on noir almost. It's almost like South Central noir. Not that Isaiah is, you know, his own, I mean, he's not in his own way, but your books remind me an awful lot of Elmore Leonard. Has anybody ever told you that?
I've heard that a few times, and it's interesting because he's my hero. He's the guy that I stole the most from. Elmore Leonard and Walter Mosley. And I'm an admirer of all things Leonard and Mosley. They were the two most influential writers in my life.
Yeah, I think I read everything that Elmore Leonard wrote, and he kind of wrote, maybe I'm wrong, but he kind of wrote very tongue-in-cheek, as far as I'm concerned, but he also did not use a lot of flowery narrative. He kind of just, I think there's a quote somewhere that says, you know, don't write what people don't want to read. You know, I'm paraphrasing, obviously, from Elmore Leonard, but there, you know, I don't want a book to slow down because someone wants to describe a scene to me that really is irrelevant to the story. Now, you know, obviously you have to have narrative in there. You've got to have prose and everything. But I find that your books read for me at a nice clip. I can always go back and reread something because I like Isaiah's speech and I like his thought process. So a lot of times I'll find myself spinning back and reading it again. And I also read a lot of it out loud because I think that registers in a different part of your brain and your comprehension. I may be wrong, but it does for me.
Yes, it does.
So I don't like listening to audiobooks because I kind of tune out, but I do like reading them out loud. And I remember specifically reading Elmore Leonard's books out loud too. And some literature, not a lot. I'm not smart enough to read literary fiction that often, but
I don't believe that.
I just don't. I'm a genre girl. There's no doubt about it. But I like the fact that there's always action in your books. Whenever I'm reading Isaiah, I know there's going to be action. Very little downtime. And that makes an enjoyable read for me. And it's not the length of the book. It's the pace, I think, of the storytelling. Does that sound right?
You and I like the same thing.
Yeah,
I like things to move forward, whether it's revealing character or relationships or the adventure itself. I want things to happen to the individuals as well as the story beats. And I write thinking I want everything to count. I want everything to count.
So yeah.
I don't want the readers to read something that's not interesting. And I really strive for that. I really do.
Well, it works because everything seems relevant to me. Now, I just finished Wrecked a couple weeks ago. And no, it was probably longer than that because I got the arc as soon as it was available. But everything felt not tied together, but relevant, whatever was going on. Because obviously you've got to have red herrings here and there. But everything was relevant that happened in your story. And I really like that a lot. So this is book number 3. You've finished your manuscript for number 4. When you look back at you when you were writing IQ, what do you see then and what do you see now?
Well, then I had extremely low expectations. I mean, I knew I'd written a good book, but would anybody want to read it?
Ever wrong, Joe? You were so wrong on that count.
I mean, really, I mean, when I thought about it, you know, here's this, you know, I finished and I have this huge paralyzing moment of who will read this? You know, here's this guy, you know, and he's solving crimes in the hood and he gets paid with blueberry muffins. Well, why would anybody want to read that? And it came as such a big surprise. I thought that I would either publish and flog copies out of the trunk of my car or get published by a small house. And, you know, I would have had a published book. So for all this to happen is really amazing. I still walk around incredulous. And looking back on it now,
you were so wrong about your first book because it just shot to the top of everyone's list. And it couldn't have been, it just was magnificent. And I know that it was a bestseller for you. Righteous to me was just every bit as good and now Wrecked. And I'm thrilled with it. And I'm thrilled with your success for you. do you notice a change in the way you approach your writing, Joe, from when you first wrote IQ?
Yeah, I'm much more confident now. You know, I when you write your first book, you question everything. And,
right.
You know, from the standpoint of, you know, does this read right? Is it entertaining? Does it have pace? You're asking yourself all of these questions all of the time. And as I've written the other two books, I got more confident. You know, I'm more sure of my own decisions, and I don't have to sweat every little thing anymore. So it's been liberating, actually, to be able to write what you want to write and write it faster, not hurrying, but
right.
You know, you've had a lot of practice.
Sure. Well, stylistically, the books appear to be the same, so you're still writing what you want to write, obviously. But I can see that. But so here's the question. You've gotten more confidence in your writing ability. Do you still get nervous about book releases?
Oh, sure. Oh, yeah. You know, it's just, you know, you think, well, this is the one that's going to tank. No, you've had too many good reviews, and, you know, you have to misstep at some point. So, you know, I don't know. You know, I mean, I don't know what people are going to say. And, you know, there's also this dichotomy between, you know, writing for yourself and writing for your audience. You know,
sure.
Writing for yourself, that just means exactly what it is. I write what I want to write. But writing for your audience, you know, means being able to communicate that clearly and entertainingly. And what you owe your audience is competence. But you just don't know how they're going to respond. I mean, this book is much darker than the previous two, and I didn't plan it that way. You know, I can only write what occurs to me.
Mm-hmm.
That's how it came out, and that people like it is really terrific.
How much of your screenwriting, you know, woeful as you say it was, but the art of screenwriting comes into play when you're writing a novel?
Yeah, it does. Screenwriting helped me in a couple of ways. One is brevity, you know, be able to say something succinctly. And, you know, the screenplay format is such that you don't have hardly any room at all to say what you want to say and say it with impact. So that really helped. And story structure in a screenplay is much clearer. It's much simpler, and yet it's very similar in terms of structure with a novel. And so knowing structure helped. The thing that was shocking was that when I started to write IQ, that my long-form narrative prose was terrible. You know, in a screenplay, if it's a nice house in suburbia, in a screenplay, all you have to write is exterior nice house in suburbia.
Right.
But they they don't let you get away with
that in
the book.
Yeah,
it took me a full year. You know, it took me a full year just to learn how to write, you know, clear, decent prose. And the second 2 years, I kind of you know, found my own style.
Before I let you go, I want to ask you just a couple of things. You read a lot yourself, don't you?
Yes, I do.
Who are you reading right now?
I just finished Ivy Pachoda's Wonder Valley, which is going to be an LA classic. It is a wonderful, haunting, frightening, sad book, and I just finished that. And it's a terrific book. And I've always avoided Joe Nesbo, just because his character's name Harry Hole. I thought that was silly. I mean, I just thought it was silly, and I thought they might be silly books, but I was terribly wrong. So I just finished a Joe Nesbo binge, and that's what I've been reading as of late.
I almost think that probably in his native language, it probably isn't Harry Hole, but you know, I've never had a chance to interview him, and I know it's not Joe Nesbo either, but. Yeah, I know there's a different pronunciation for his name, but for those of us who don't speak that particular language, Joe Nesbo works. I like his books too. And yes, it is funny reading that book. It almost, you know, takes you aside. But you know, there are a lot of them like that too. So, you know, what do you do anything outside of reading and writing? Do you have like any hobbies, Joe?
I like to go fly fishing. That's my thing.
Really?
I like to go someplace beautiful and stand in a creek and fly fish. I'm a hacker. I'm terrible actually at fly fishing, but it occupies just enough of your brain so that you can't think of anything else.
It's very zen.
And so in that sense,
it's very zen. Yes.
Yes.
Now,
and plus, you're in beautiful places.
Yeah, well, and you're calm and you're disconnected from everything, so that's kind of nice too. Is it true that you and are friends with another writer who also happens to be a very well-known athlete named Kareem Abdul-Jabbar?
Yeah, surprisingly, I found out through one of his publicists that he's a fan of the books, and he was kind enough to send me a picture of himself holding a copy of Righteous. And then he was having an event here in LA about his own book, the Mycroft books. And this publicist, who I've known for a long time, she snuck me backstage and I met him. And he's warm and he's thoughtful and he's quiet. And he has this extensive field of knowledge about many things. And it was a terrific experience. You know, it really was. And I tell you, before you die, you need to shake hands with somebody who's 7'2".
Yeah, I guess you do.
Watch your hand disappear.
Oh my God.
But he was kind and I mean, we just talked. Like two guys.
I know that he's a very smart man, and I know he's written a lot of books. I have tried to reach out to his publisher to invite him on the show, but, you know, like a lot of times they just ignore me. And one of these days, maybe, you know, I'd love for you two to come on and have a conversation together if you ever want to do that. That would be a fun interview. Just being your tech, you know, if you want to arrange that one day, I'm all in for that, because I love hearing authors talk to each other and see what their thought processes are, their writing processes, how they're similar and how they're different. You know, it's always an interesting conversation.
Right.
Tell everybody where we can find you on the interwebs, please.
Let's see. I'm going to San Francisco tomorrow.
Okay.
To a couple of different bookstores. It's on my Facebook page and my Twitter page. And then I'm going to Seattle. Also to appear at another bookstore. I wish I could remember the names of all these places, but they elude me. but the information is there.
They just tell you where to go and you go, right? Now,
yeah.
I hope one day you come to Southwest Florida. I'd love to meet you in person one of these days. I feel like we've known each other we have known each other since your first book came out. And I'm thrilled that you've come back, Joe. Thank you so much. Thank you so, so much for being here. I love talking to you every time you're here. Folks, the new book is called Wrecked. It is available now. Go get Joe Ide's book. You will not be disappointed. And if you haven't started with IQ, you really got to. It's an amazing book. Joe Ide.
Thank you, my friend. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And you and I will talk soon. Have a wonderful, wonderful holiday season.
I will. You too, Pam.
All righty. Bye-bye. And that's our show for now. Thanks for joining me today. Tomorrow, I'm with international best-selling women's fiction writer Susan Mallory at 4 o'clock. And then at 6, it is a book reviewers panel. Everything you always wanted to know about being a book reviewer, and how and what they look for. Thanks for being with me, and thank you, Mom and Dad. Bye.